If a small flock of cartoon bluebirds didn't help you get dressed this morning, that just means you haven't yet listened to Fine Tuning with Jim Hill and Drew Taylor. No, the black dress slacks, please. Thank you. And now, Jim Hill.
Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm Drew's co-host, entertainment writer Jim Hill, and this is our second show for June 2019. We're recording this on Sunday, June 9th, which is just after the box office numbers for Secret Life of Pets have came in, and ooh, Drew. Wow. Yeah.
Did you see it?
Not yet. The original Secret Life of Pets has been all over cable this past weekend, and so it was sort of revisiting that one, getting ready to go out and see this one. And when that came out in 2016, over its opening weekend in domestic release, it made $104 million, where the second film only made $47 million. I mean, that's less than half.
And it's just continuing the streak of animated films underperforming this year.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it doesn't entirely make any sense, but let's save that for the second half of the show. But today is Donald Duck's 85th birthday.
Yeah, I mean, he looks good for 85.
You know, he does. I think. He does. And you just discovered the latest Mickey Mouse short, which Paul Reddish and company put out, which is sort of a very Donald-centric episode.
Yeah, yeah. Did you watch? Did you get a chance to watch it before?
I did. And, well, the note that Drew sent me is like, it's a kind of an 80s celebration. It's Donald and Daisy and Minnie and Mickey playing tennis, but Donald is channeling Andre Agassi.
Yeah, yeah. And they're sort of like the mean kids in like an 80s sports movie. And they look great. There's some good twists to that episode, too.
Oh, but at the same time, I love the overly aggressive 80s soundtrack.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really awesome. I thought it was great.
No, they always do such nice work there. And every time when I see one of these shorts, it makes me want them to really get moving on Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway. If this is what they're doing with the shorts, I can't wait to see what they do with the attraction.
Oh, yeah. Dying for that one.
Speaking of dying, if you go to Jurassic World, chances are you're going to come back with a few fewer fingers.
Yes, correct.
So Camp Jurassic, is this what the new series is called? Or
Camp Cretaceous.
Camp Cretaceous, that's right.
Yes, which is coming next year on Netflix. And they released a very teasery teaser for it that didn't show really any animation. But we know that it's going to be 3D animation that Amblin is producing. Mm-hmm. That Spielberg and Colin Trevorrow and Frank Marshall are involved. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It's interesting that there's a new Universal-based animated properties that are going to Netflix when they have a direct-to-consumer platform in the works and also are a part of Comcast now, which has cable channels. So it's just really interesting to me that they're still going with Netflix when they have all these other avenues. But I don't know what that's about.
I agree, but at the same time, what I love is when you came across, this is not the first attempt at a Jurassic Park, Jurassic World animated series. You just sent me those seven amazing pieces of early art by William Stout for, I guess, they tried to do it in the 90s, or?
Yeah, in 2015, William Stout, who I think I speak for both of us, is saying one of our favorite illustrators and concept artists, right? He released a bunch of images from this show that was going to be made in the 1990s, and he says that upon the success of Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park, all kinds of ancillary products were announced, toys, games, novelties, apparel, etc. Towards the end of this merchandising, I got a call from artist Will Montague asking if I'd be interested in designing a Jurassic Park animated series. And he said it was not going to be a kiddie show, but that I was aiming for, quote, a mature primetime series with top writers and state-of-the-art television animation, augmented with quite a bit of CG animation, with the series boasting what Stout called a graphic novel look. So clearly this was very ahead of its time, but he says all we needed was Spielberg's approval. But by the time the word got out that he was burnt out on Jurassic Park merchandising and all the film's commercial exploitation, so it never got made.
That's a heartbreaker, because this art is amazing. And you're right, it genuinely does have that sort of graphic novel feel. And these are not cute dinosaurs. These are, out of the 7 images you sent along, I think 3 of them show, you know, people in mortal peril.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he's amazing, and he's done a lot of work. I mean, speaking of dinosaur and Disney, he did, you know, a lot of work on the Countdown to Extinction attraction, including those great posters that I'm not sure if they're still outside of the attraction, because weren't they produced with McDonald's, those pictures of, like, dinosaurs eating each other and stuff like that?
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, he's amazing.
What this makes me think of is, I want to say that William Stout's coffee table book came out last year, and I think, like me, every year when you go to Comic-Con, you eventually make your way to Bill's table and pick up the latest sketchbooks, because they're always amazing. And he's worked on so much stuff. Talking about dinosaur, he was one of the first people through the door working on Disney's Secret Lab project, and did hundreds of sketches and drawings for that. You know, he would kind of the dinosaur guy in the industry for a while. And didn't he also do some work on Favreau's Magic Kingdom project, which you and I obsess about endlessly?
Yeah, he did. Haven't you seen some of those images? Didn't he show you some?
No, this is the thing. It's one of these things where it's like, I had to be in the right place at the right time to see those. And
so what were the images, if you can remember?
The story, as it was explained to me, is that Bill was the guy that Favreau went to sort of kind of define the look. I mean, again, for those of you who don't remember the conceit of, you know, Favreau's Magic Kingdom, the gimmick was, well, basically, it's Night at the Museum at Disneyland. And Bill was the guy, well, what would that look like? You know, what would it look like to have Abraham Lincoln hanging out with, you know, Jack Sparrow, or, you know, that sort of thing? I guess they were looking for the 3 or 4 master paintings that they were going to use to then sell Disney execs on this. Because this isn't a question of doing, like, taking a single Disney IP, like, say, Tim Burton and Dumbo. This is like taking every single IP the company has and putting them in one film. It's a big roll of the dice, especially if you do it wrong. And it's been at least 5 years that this thing has been bubbling up and then cooling off and then bubbling up and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's ever going to, I don't think it's ever going to actually happen, but.
The craziest part of this idea, and I think we've talked about this in an earlier fine tuning, is that there was the version of this that was going to be done as a Disney afternoon show. I mean, it was sort of was in that same pile of shows that get pitched along with things like Thumper's Thicket and 00 Duck. But, you know, the whole notion was that at one point there was, somewhere up in the clouds, there was literally a Magic Kingdom where the Country Bears did battle with the Pirates of the Caribbean characters. And it says a lot about the idea that even Eisner, who, you know, yeah, that's probably not a good idea. Let's go do something else. And I don't know if this is a good idea, but what did you think of the Camp Coral announcement earlier? I mean, look, we've known since February that there was supposedly a SpongeBob spinoff coming, but what did you think of the announcement?
Well, I thought it was interesting because it's going to be CG. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember when they were saying that they're probably going to be multiple spinoffs. So this is probably just the first one. But I thought it was interesting that it's going to be CG. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that this stuff has only happened since Hillenburg has died. That is sort of an do you think he was kind of against this stuff?
Did you see the tweet that Paul Tibbett put out?
No.
He'd been involved with the SpongeBob since the very first season of the show. He actually directed the SpongeBob movie Sponge Out of Water and was the showrunner as late as 2015. He actually tweeted this out just the other day, Drew. It's like, I mean no disrespect to my colleagues who are working on this show. They are good people and talented artists, but this is some greedy, lazy executiving right here, and they all know full well Steve would have hated this. Shame on them.
Wow.
This 13-episode first season of the show, and again, the conceit is we're going to get to meet 10-year-old SpongeBob who, during a summer at sleepaway camp, but this is actually a spinoff of the It's a Wonderful Sponge movie?
Okay, that was a TV movie, though.
Well, no, right? This is now going to be theatrically released in May of 2020.
Oh, yes, this has been on the books for a long
time. Yeah, in fact, it originally supposed to release to theaters in February of this year, February 9th, then got pushed back to August, then pushed all the way back to July of 2020, then started creeping into July 17th until finally this May 2020 thing. But this is the log line for the movie. It's like, set before the events of the TV series, SpongeBob goes on a trip to Camp Coral and meets some new friends. However, when his pet snail Gary gets kidnapped by Poseidon and taken to the lost city of Atlantic City, he and his new best friend Patrick must go on a rescue mission to save him from the dastardly plan of Poseidon before it's too late. So this is actually a spinoff of...
It's a spinoff of a movie that hasn't come out yet.
Yeah, but how different is this from the Wonder Park business plan? Because remember, the movie, that was setting up a series as well.
Yeah, have we gotten any confirmation on what happened to that series? Or
the phrase they wanted to use was they wanted some breathing space between theatrical release and the Blu-ray and the DVD before that comes out. So I think we're looking at the fall of this year, possibly early winter.
Okay.
You mentioned the show being done in CG. I actually have a friend who was sort of involved in the convincing Hillenburg that the characters could, in fact, be done in CG. Are you familiar with the SpongeBob sub-pants attraction?
No, I'm not. Where
well,
is
it,
this?
Well, it was built in Moody Gardens in Galveston, Texas. It's kind of a science museum meets a themed attraction kind of a thing. This actually opened in May of 2015, and the SpongeBob Sponge Out of Water movie, which features that sequence at the end where the characters are done in CG and become superheroes as they battle...
Oh, Antonio Banderas.
Okay. Hillenburg, evidently, they come at him multiple times about doing the characters in CG, and it's like, no, this guy was very, very protective of SpongeBob right from the beginning. And speaking of which, I'm a little confused. SpongeBob debuted on Nick July 17th, 1999. That means this year is the 20th anniversary. Is there anything out there pushing that, or?
I don't think so. I haven't heard of anything, but yeah, that's weird that they would let an anniversary like that go by the wayside.
I agree. Well, anyway, okay, so the thing of SpongeBob subpants was that you literally got into a theater, and it was this marriage sort of the kind of a Star Tours-y moving theater thing coupled with a Turtle Talk. There was a cast member off stage who was working Patrick, and Patrick would be taking real-time answers from the audience as the audience could literally vote as to where they were going to go on the attraction. And now, mind you, again, this opens May of 2015, and Turtle Talk with Crush, that opened November 2004 at Epcot. So, you know, this is a full 11 years after that. But it was highly thought enough that the very next year for the Theo Awards, it was given special recommendation by, or special recognition by folks who work in themed entertainment, because it's like, oh my God, this is an amazing attraction. But it was during the development phase when they were doing the real-time CG version of Patrick that they brought Hillenburg in like 2 and 3 years out. And he was just floored that the CG could make a 2D character look like a 2D character. It literally brought him around to the idea, well, hell, we could maybe do this with Sponge Out of Water. But it was the attraction, at least the attraction in demo form, that convinced him that, you know, yeah, you could do these characters in CG. So I guess I don't necessarily have that sort of a problem with Camp Coral, but again, that comment by Paul Tibbett, that's kind of hard to walk around.
Yeah, that's pretty distressing. Also, who knew that there was anything worthwhile in Galveston? I grew up in Texas, and I know I've been to Galveston, and it is bleak. But now I want to go see this attraction.
I've heard amazing things about Moody Gardens. I definitely have to get down there at some point. All right, so when we get back from our commercial break here, Drew and I will do a deeper dive, maybe borrowing SpongeBob subpants, to look at what happened with Secret Life of Pets 2.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Top of the show, we were talking about this. So $47 million compared to how the first film did in 2016?
Mm-hmm.
104 million versus 47 million. You were mentioning, Drew, that this is kind of the pattern for the year, at least when it comes to animation.
Yeah, I mean, every animated movie that has come out this year so far has disappointed. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Missing Link from Laika or How to Train Your Dragon 3 from DreamWorks Animation or now this from Illumination. Obviously, Wonder Park we just talked about being like that. That's the like catastrophic fail of the year. But Lego Movie 2 from Warner, I mean, there has not been one studio that's been immune to this disappointing animation sort of continuity. So what makes me curious about Secret Life of Pets, as every time I go to Universal, I take a picture of this massive show building that they're building for the attraction. It's like, what are they going to do with that if nobody wants to see these characters anymore?
You're dead on. That's a big attraction for summer of 2020 for Universal Studios Hollywood. But plans were supposedly already in the works in much the same way that Fast and Furious Supercharged went from being the grand finale of the tram tour to a standalone attraction at Universal Studios Florida. Secret Life of Pets was already supposedly tentatively scheduled to be built at the studios in Orlando, not to mention Japan, and even the Beijing park evidently had already sort of mapped out an expansion pad. It wasn't necessarily going to be opening day, but, you know, they were sort of creating an Illumination's land. The original Secret Life of Pets opens in theaters July of 2016. August of that same year, you have Comcast buys DreamWorks Animation for $3.8 million, and then puts Chris Meleandri, the gentleman who's been in charge of Illuminations, in charge of both studios, kind of doing the John Lasseter, what they did in 2006 when Disney bought Pixar and John became chief creative officer for both places. And one of the things that came down immediately was that they were going to concentrate on making the most of existing IPs. And they shut down the Mumbai musical.
Yeah, Mumbai musical, Larrikins, The Shadow, Boo, The Shadow movie.
But it was all about, we want to make the most of the IPs that we already have. And so that was a thing. So of course, you know, Secret Life of Pets, the original one, when it was out in theaters, made $875 million worldwide. So of course it was like, you know, you got within a billion and, you know, of course we're going to do something there. But I think you've nailed it. You know, the whole notion of there was a plan for this. They were hoping in much the same way of how Despicable Me has become, you know, a full-blown franchise. And just last month, there was supposed to be a Minions 2 and a Despicable Me 4, and they seem to have merged the two, that there's...
Yeah, I've been trying to get some clarification on that, because the Minions sequel is called the Rise of Gru or something. Yeah, so they haven't announced that Steve Carell is coming back or anything, but I'm very interested in what that is. Yeah, they seem to kind of have merged those two threads of the franchise, which I don't know if that's a bad idea.
No. I you know, face it, when you've made it to four, you know, in fact, I think the thing, honestly, that frightened a lot of people is what happened with Ice Age 5. The notion of you had this franchise that was making so much money, and then you did the fifth one, and box office worldwide went down. And it's just sort of like, what is there left to say? Where, on the other hand, as recently as September of 2017, you had Chris Meleandri talking about how a fourth Despicable Me film was in the works.
We remember what Chris used to oversee, which is Blue Sky, and he oversaw the creation of Ice Age. So to draw another parallel to something that's also unfolding, with Godzilla and the Godzilla King of the Monsters, which is not doing well. Did you see
we
it?
We did.
I thought it was fun.
I picked up a copy of The Art of Godzilla King of the Monsters. What's amazing is you page through this book and, you know, you have the director, Doherty.
Yeah, Mike Doherty.
Yep. And, you know, this is a guy who, as a kid, begged his parents one Christmas for, I guess there was a Godzilla sort of Power Ranger kind of crossover. And, you know, he begged and pleaded, and they got it to her for Christmas. And he's carried it with him. It was in his college dorm room. It's in his office at Warner's. And you go through this book, and there's all this amazing concept art. You clearly had these huge fans of kaiju movies, and, you know, they really wanted to make a great Godzilla movie. And we sat at the theater like 90 minutes in, where it's, you know, time for yet another conversation. You know, it's like, just get to the monsters. Every so often, it would actually be a Godzilla movie.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when you have to actually entertain yourself by going, wow, the design of the Monarch base inside of the, you know, the oil rig is really cool.
Yeah.
For me, the very fact that the Producers Guild of America this past week was having sort of its summit, and the guys from Warner were talking about, Godzilla King Kong, which was supposed to come out in March, we may push the date on that. We may push that back.
Really?
I think that's on the heels of Godzilla King of the Monsters didn't do the numbers that was expected. And yeah, I guess the plan was they were planning on building on the heat that, you know, the notion of, you know, you saw this one in May. Well, you don't have to wait a full year. You know, come March, here's King Kong versus Godzilla. And just this past week, the licensing show was in Las Vegas. And, you know, there was these giant banners for King Kong versus Godzilla. They were doing the full court press for licensing T-shirts and toys. And evidently, you know, people were avoiding them like the plague.
It's crazy, especially because Kong vs. Godzilla is a direct sequel to this one.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I mean, it's not the same thing as building a theme park attraction, but it is one of those things where Hollywood thinks, oh, this is a sure bet, and then it's not, and they have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on something that they wish they could take back now. You know, it's crazy.
If you can chase down this book, because the absolutely masterful, beautiful pieces of concept art and character design, and clearly a very passionate group of people worked on this movie. And yet you watch the film and it's just sort of like, I spent a lot of my formative years in Boston. And, you know, the finale of the film is basically King Ghidorah and Godzilla duking it out, you know, flattening all of Boston. And it's like, given the way it was done with it's at night and it's raining, and it's like, you know, half the time he's knocking down buildings and it's like, is that the Hancock Tower?
Right.
You're trying to suss out what I'm actually looking at. And I was watching it conventionally projected. I wasn't doing the 3D IMAX where you lose 20% of it to darkness and all that.
Right, yeah.
Would it kill them to do a Godzilla movie during the day? Or at least leave a light on.
Yes.
Okay, you know.
Yeah. Well, I also have to bring up something, you know. I have a real beef with you, Jim, that you did this entire show for Lens, you know, podcast about Atlantis. We could have made that a show here. We got to do, people need more Atlantis content.
Well,
you know?
I think it would, actually, yes. That's one of those films that always kind of breaks my heart, because on the heels of that, was it Weiss left the studio and Trousdale stayed, or was it the other way around?
Well, wasn't Trousdale doing things for DreamWorks for a
while? He was. He did the, I want to say he did the Shrek holiday special, and
yeah, God, how do you go from directing the first animated movie to be nominated for Best Picture to a Shrek animated special?
But interestingly enough, to bring this full circle, Chris Melandri has basically flat out said that there's another Shrek film in the works.
Yeah. Well, Kirk stuck around because he was doing like the English language translations of the Hayao Miyazaki movies. That's right. And stuff. And he worked on Chimpanzee for some reason, the Disney Nature movie.
I've had a couple of meetings at our office, Drew, the Bob's Big Boy, and to look alike with Don Hahn. And he told amazing stories about working on Atlantis and just, you know, and how impossible it was to be working at Disney during that period and trying to explain to the people who were now in charge of animation, you know, about we should make this movie. For him to go from working on that to then working on Fraidy Cat, which, you know, he was like, there was a genuinely great movie there.
Right. Well, what also always fascinates me about Atlantis is that Mike Mignola was brought in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, much like Gerald Scarfe or Scarfy on Hercules, like, it was so cool that they brought in this outside artist. And I actually talked to him a few years ago about it, and he was very candid about, you know, the experience and what it was like. But I want to dig up that Joss Whedon version of the screenplay.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That. In fact, somebody was just pointing out to me that the thing of telling the Atlantis story and about how the two attractions that didn't get built, the Atlantean Expedition for Disneyland and Fire Mountain for Walt Disney World's Magic Kingdom, the irony is that if you actually take the step back and then realize, well, look at Tokyo Disney Seas, and you have Mount Prometheus, which erupts all the time. They actually have a Sinbad attraction there that was designed for that park, though, oddly enough, that's another one of those Alan Menken stories that they brought him in 5 years after the park opened to redo the soundtrack, and it then became Sinbad's storybook adventures. And it's fascinating to watch the original version of Sinbad and then compare it to story, you know, Sinbad's storybook adventures. But I got to caution you that if you ever make the mistake of actually listening to Sinbad's storybook adventures, the theme song that Menken came up with is such an earworm, it will never leave your head. It's such a smart redo of the attraction. I mean, if you watch them side by side, they take something that's kind of dark and kind of problematic and turn it into this just complete home run. And in fact, the tiger cub that Sinbad travels with, you know, they even introduced the plush that you have to buy on your way out.
Yeah, I was saying they put out a bunch of new stuff with that tiger cub. That's where we're hoping to go on our honeymoon. And I told that to Alan Menken. I said, we're going to go to Japan, and partially because of I have to hear your song for the Sinbad.
Oh, right. That's
loved
great.
That.
That's right.
But I have to ask you, do you know what the Mexican restaurant was where they came up with Atlantis? I'm guessing it was Don Cuco's, but I don't know.
I actually pressed him on that, and he was talking about how it's Burbank. You know, the thing is, the rest, you know, I think it's been three different things since we ate there. I mean, you know Burbank to look alike. In fact, that's, I think, one of the reasons why we go to our office. You know, the Bob's, they can't ever kill Bob's, where everything else around Bob's just becomes another Starbucks.
Well, we'll have to go next time you're in town. We'll go to Bob's. We'll get Don Hahn there. We'll do a live taping from Bob's with Don Hahn. I think it could be great.
And speaking of Mr. Hahn, just this past weekend, they had a gallery show. Don has a new book out. Believe it or not, it's called Hahn, H-A-H-N, Solo, The Paintings of Don Hahn. Don publishes a lot of the paintings he does these days on Facebook, and they're gorgeous stuff. So okay, we just plugged your book, Don. You got to talk to us now. We got to, you know, we got to get the Atlantis stories. Well, anyway, speaking of your honeymoon, which means the wedding, which means, by the way, Drew's getting married next weekend, so kind of a busy guy. So how about this? Why don't we shut this down now so you can, I don't know, maybe mail out the invitations or...
We're just waiting for your yes or no, Jim. That's all we're waiting
for.
I'm
sorry. Right, it's the chicken or the fish, Drew. I can't decide. So. All right. Anyway, folks, that will do it for this week. As crazy as things are you still getting light diffuses out the door?
Oh, yeah. Oh, did you listen to the Paul Hirsch episode yet?
Well, yeah. Very killer. In fact, by the way, I wanted to point out, you've just launched a Patreon for this, right? Or...
Yes, we have. And so if you want to help us out, we'd really appreciate it. And we just recorded an entire commentary track for the first movie. So you can listen to our commentary track while watching it. It syncs up perfectly. And we're going to be doing that for each movie. We're going to bring in special guests for some of the commentaries. So we're plugging away. But yeah, Paul Hirsch will be the next couple of episodes. The third episode is almost exclusively Star Wars stuff. So you and Dan Z will have to listen to it and pick it apart.
Definitely, you know, talk that up the next time we do a Looking at Lucasfilm. But my side of the fence, the usual crud here, folks. Disney Dish with Len Testa. We've got Looking at Lucasfilm, as I just mentioned, with Dan Z. We've got Universal Joint with Dustin Fuse. We've got I Want That, the Disney Merch Podcast, which I do with Michelle Valladolid. And, of course, we have Marvelous Disney. If you like what Drew and I do here, if you get over to iTunes and rate and recommend our shows, that would be great. If you really, really, really like what we do here, you could swing over to Bandcamp and subscribe. That would be terrific. Likewise, for Light the Fuse, if you could help out with Drew's Patreon efforts, I would really, really appreciate that. And I think that does it for this week, folks. Thanks for listening, and once he gets back from his honeymoon, we'll record a new show. Till then, take care, okay?
Be sure to tune in again for another fine episode of Fine Tuning with Jim Hill and Drew Taylor.